Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, December 19th. Maui has turned a corner with the signing of a bill into law that aims to rein in short-term rentals. There's still a long road ahead. We look at what comes next. We head out to the north shore of Kauai to meet a kalo farmer whose family has been working the land for six generations. And we hear a rare recording of the grunge band Nirvana from a Hawaii performance that took place 33 years ago. Plus, let trade winds flow. It's a new photo exhibit that highlights an architectural feature that is all about good design. Once you notice this, you won't be able to unsee it. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, Mayor Richard Bisson signed Bill 9 into law. The measure aims to restrict short-term rentals in an effort to boost long-term housing. But will it? And are there legal challenges to come? HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel joins us this morning. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so a big week.
It is. So as you said, this law passed. I'm sure everyone is kind of tired of hearing about it by now, but it did finally pass after a really long and divisive process over the past couple of years. So the law phases out about 7,000 short-term rentals in Maui County. That's about half of the rental units on Maui over the next 5 years. It's a phased approach. And just to remind folks, this only applies to apartment-zoned districts, so there are still a lot of short-term rentals in hotel areas and other zones that will continue operating. Most of the units affected are located in South Maui and West Maui, and, you know, as you said, the mayor proposed it back in May 2024 with the goal of freeing up housing for local residents, and, you know, he says kind of finding that balance between the tourism economy and the local community.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a real touchy subject, you know, just because the disaster with the wildfires really just put the focus on the need for housing.
Absolutely. You know, it's the housing crisis is not new, but certainly the wildfires really brought it to the forefront. And we saw people simply not being able to find a place to live. Huge housing crunch. And, you know, it's something that Maui is still struggling with. You know, I think another thing that made this both positive and, you know, we saw the negative sides of it as well, was just the level of public involvement in this process. And I think that's part of what made this bill noteworthy, was just the level of passion that it brought out on both sides. You know, we heard hours and hours and hours of public testimony, pretty evenly split really between those folks who were supporting it and those who were against. But I think coming out of it, it's really raised this level of public involvement in the lawmaking process. And we saw, you know, just a much greater, higher numbers of people in those Maui County Council chambers ready to testify, ready to make their voices heard on both sides. And, you know, I think it's kind of in keeping with communities around the world that are wrestling with what happens when tourism kind of feels like it's, you know, taking priority in some places over residents. And so, you know, global percentages of short-term rentals in relation to housing supply is kind of interesting to look at. So LA, Boston, Barcelona, London, all of those cities have around 1-3% of short-term rentals in relation to their total housing. Maui is at 21% of short-term rentals, and that's higher than anywhere else in the state. So I think that has really brought this issue to the front. And again, you know, supporters are saying really about finding that balance. Maui, you know, has taken action. And I think a lot of communities around the world are going to be kind of looking to this to see what happens next. It could be really precedent setting for, you know, communities in Hawaii as well as around the world.
Well, what does happen? I mean, you know, there's been lots of talk about the Minutoya list. And so there's concern about legal challenges.
Absolutely. You mentioned the Minutoya list, and that's kind of a name that has been used for these apartments that were built in the 80s. The county says they are originally for workforce housing, and so the intent is to bring them back to that use. But, you know, what happens next is really a big unknown at this point. So for owners of these properties, they can either convert to long-term rentals, which is kind of the county's hope, right, in all of this. They can sell their units, they can keep them for personal use, or they can seek a change in zoning from apartment zone to, for example, hotel zone that would allow them to continue operating. The phase-out timeline is, for West Maui, the deadline to end vacation rentals in these units is January 1st, 2029. Other areas of the county is January 1st, 2031. And, you know, you mentioned legal challenges. I think the county is certainly preparing for those. There's been a lot of individuals and groups that have said they are planning to challenge it in court. One of the things that was discussed in the council's passing of this bill was findings from the council's temporary investigative group that assembled during this process to kind of take a look at this from a different angle. They came up with some recommendations. One of those recommendations was to look at these zoning changes and potentially include them in the bill. We can talk about that in a minute, but the council's lawyers advised not having amendments in the bill because they said that made it more defensible in court. You know, they certainly didn't give more detail than that, but the bill did pass clean, quote unquote, which means as it was originally written. Council members are considering this companion legislation that would look at these zoning changes. So instead of incorporating it into Bill 9, as many people, you know, many folks who opposed it kind of hoped they would, the council decided to consider separate legislation. It will go through its own process. It has to go through all of the county planning commissions, another long thing with lots of public testimony. But they are considering creating a separate and new hotel zone that a lot of these properties could fall under. And so that might actually allow over 4,000 of these affected properties to actually continue operating as they were, as short-term rentals. It would kind of exempt them from this bill. And so a lot of unknowns going forwards, again, with legal challenges could extend the timeline potentially, and this companion legislation could potentially make it, you know, dilute the bill a little bit.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, you know, what happens in court and what prevails. Certainly, yes, something we'll be watching. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. You can look for her coverage on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn about a quick and easy way to request service from the city and county of Honolulu. We'll hear about a new and improved HNL 311 system that allows you to report issues in your community. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
We started the week with a look at a book that focused on women cultivating food sovereignty. Today we end a week with a closer look at a farm on the Garden Isle. Sierra Lynn Stone's family has been farming on the north shore of Kauai for six generations. What started out with small rice production grew into a large kalo farm. SBH Taro Farms takes its name from Stone's maiden name, Boru Harada, tracking the history of the people who have worked the land. More recently, Stone and her husband have added fruit trees and cattle to the mix. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson recently visited Kauai to take a closer look at what shared work and land has meant to the family.
My full name is Sierra Lynn Stone, and I am a sixth-generation Wahine Kala farmer. I remember as far back as my great-grandfather. Like, he was around. I remember living with him. And then beyond that, my sister knew, like, a couple of the older ones because she was older. And there's still some siblings, my great-grandfather's brothers and sisters still alive. There's a couple of them left. So they're always here on island from Oahu, and they always ask to come down to go see the valley. To them, it's home. They remember it as home. My grandfather's, like, dad and his family used to live in here. So up beyond, like, where those mango trees are and what have you, that's where their, like, huts and houses were. And they used to have a mano, so, like, a big, like, large pool, if you will, that used to, like, flow down in the awai, and they use the water, however, for baths, for washing. And that was sourcing those fields at a point in time. And there were, like, five families. There was a, like, Filipino, several Japanese families that all lived in there. My grandfather, he did taro as like a side hustle, basically. They were doing rice originally back in like the 40s, and then like late 50s is kind of where they started to introduce taro. I remember swimming in the ditches, like catching bullfrogs, you name it. We had like the golf carts, and we got to go like tubing. So a lot of camping growing up, a lot of summer outdoor lifestyle. We used to have those really big old school loud generators, and that's what like sourced our light, and then my television with my Nintendo. So like, I have fond memory.
I love Nintendo on the farm.
I made it happen. We would catch bullfrogs. We would take showers in hot water in the Rubbermaid wheelbarrows. Yeah, I've got great stories. Like learning how to drive like a golf cart, crashing into ditches and being so terrified. You see the croton bush and there's like this whole ditchway. It was all the way on that side. And I was driving. We were racing, like go-kart racing, like Mario Kart. And I lost control and I went straight into the ditch. And I was fine, but the cart was stuck. And I was like, oh no, like my grandfather, he's gonna be so mad at me that I crashed. I just learned how to drive. I had bricks on my pedals.
How old were you?
I was like 4, literally. And I had little bricks. So I had my little cushion, like a lumbar pillow kind of. And I had the little bricks so I could reach the pegs. But I got so excited and I was like, floor it. And I lost control and ended up in the ditch. Oh my gosh, I'm in trouble. I did something wrong. No. I wanted to run and hide and I did. And then he's like, where's the girl? He's always, where's the girl? Where's the girl? And I'd come out and he'd be like scolding me, but then he's just like, are you okay? Never mind the golf cart, that can be replaced. Are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. We'll get back up there then. Go. How you like me get the golf cart? Go over there. We're going to hook it up to the excavator. We're going to pull it. Oh, okay. Like, I know what I'm doing. My fondest memories are growing up on the farm, living that country lifestyle, and in essence, working. Little did I know, like, I was developing the habits and the characteristics early on.
You thought you were just playing and hanging out and you were acquiring knowledge and whatnot.
Exactly. Lo and behold, like, I, you know, originally went off to Washington State after high school. I wanted to do nursing. That was, like, my thing. And then my grandfather, his health started to deteriorate, like, a year into me being away. That's where the opportunity was posed, like, do you want to come home and run the farm? Because there really wasn't going to be anybody else. So no-brainer, came home and, like, still operated under him. And it was just very bare and minimal. Nothing extravagant, no large quotas.
So when he called you and said, hey, do you want to come back? You said it was a no-brainer. Why was it a no-brainer?
It just felt like that was my calling. In that moment, like, I thought my plans were going to be, you know, nursing or what have you, being away. And realistically, it was like, no, this is what you were literally born and raised to do. So, like, the feeling just felt so innate and just no questions. And I just came home and then it just started to, like, unfold. Looking back, it was a little bit more challenging being that I had to deal with my grandfather, who was how he was. But in essence, it only just allowed me to keep him around longer and I got to embrace him and learn from him that much more. Just the littlest of things that now I'm like, yeah, see, good, you listened. Like, now you know how to change that tire or, like, you know how to check the oil. And he was very traditional and old school Japanese, so they not much could get by him. He was how he was and you're not going to change it. I think he saw something in me as well, like, because we were always so close and my relationship with him was always like at the farm, literally going to school and then we're at the farm and then we're home late at night. I think he saw like me fulfilling some type of vision in his later days. So he kind of like set that path and set that tone for us. And then when we came in after he passed away, it was like, oh, okay, like the forefront's laid out. How do we just maintain and just kind of strengthen it, if you will? So since then, it's been a lot easier on our part. So we're grateful for that, Pops.
When he passed, did you feel nervous? When someone's around like that, that always knows the way and no longer around, it's different.
Oh, absolutely. I almost felt lost. But then most of me and part of me just realized, like, you know, I was built for this. Like, I was with him. He raised me. I know I'm going to encompass a lot of struggles and oppositions and challenges. And that's part of farming, though. I was like, that's the nature of it. We pivot.
It clearly is all in the family in terms of the work here, but talk us through your staff. Who's doing all of this?
It's always been intimate family working together. I have a daughter who's 3. We just started preschool, and I have my 5-month-old son. They're definitely 2 balls of fire. I will say my days are a lot different now as a mom because it is a lot, and it's a lot of adjustments. But generally, I'm up at 5:30 and I am brewing the coffee because we love the coffee. It's like my favorite time of my day, I will say. And the kids are generally sleeping. They'll stay asleep till at least 6:15. And generally my son's up first. That 5-month-old is like, I hear mom and I smell things. And I have the news going. I need to see my weather. That's important. I'm like the overseer, if you will. I'm definitely my grandpa's granddaughter. I have my type of way. I'm particular. And I take pride in that. I think it says a lot with what we yield, how we're cutting the kalo, how clean it is going into the bags. It represents SBH Taro Farms. So I take pride in all that we do. And I try to mold that and shape that in, like, everybody in my own family. My sister, my nephew, they provide insights and different means, but they're always helping, like, on the field. So they're getting in the lo'is with us. They're cleaning, they're harvesting, helping me bag things. My nephew's awesome. He's like the 25-year-old. He drives me to town on Sundays, so I ship my kalo. So I get to sit there in the passenger seat and do the paperwork. So it's great. And my husband's like my grandfather. Literally, they have the same birthday. So I literally found my grandpa. He does all the machine stuff. He comes from a heavy equipment background. So that's his jam, is like the excavator. So maintenance, tilling of the fields, prepping the patches. And his newest endeavor would be the cattle. So he's always like, I want to be a cowboy and all this good stuff. And now being able to have this lifestyle to do so, like, okay, why not? My mom's also around. I have my mom left. And so she comes on Saturdays is when we harvest, and she'll help cut the kalo. So like we normally clean it. We have like these snow sleds, and we basically clean the kalo in the field, put them all in the boats, and we bring it up on our banks. And that's where we'll cut the kalo off the stalk into these 5-gallon buckets. And then from there, we bag the buckets into the burlap bags. So my mom does a lot of the laborious cutting. And then I've got like some extended aunties and uncles that come through, and they just want to be a part of, and they're always welcome. And so we have fun. We have fun doing it. We're always here like having a good attitude. That's like where we brainstorm, where we'll talk all our ideas and just have a good time with it and run with it. And that's just kind of where things take off with our next endeavors or what have you. My husband's learning too, and he's excited, like trying different things, seeing what works better than others. So sometimes when we have our smaller fields, we'll try to do like a test run, like, okay, like let's try this fertilizer out and see what happens, or like, you know, and just take notes on these things. And we'll like, I'll record things as we harvest per field. Like, what are we, how many bags are we getting out of this patch, and compare it to the previous year or the previous yield, just to see, are we getting better? Is it lacking? And then I try to do like more consistent soil samplings, because it just varies. Like sometimes we'll have these floods like intermittently, and you never know what comes through, this sediment and whatnot.
Well, and talk to me about scale here in terms of output. What are these patches able to yield on a regular basis?
We're able to yield anywhere from like a good 150 to 160 bags from these little bit larger fields, if you will. Whereas before, we weren't even pulling 100 bags out of these fields. Like we weren't fertilizing, or we weren't doing our soil testing, and we weren't doing any of those types of things. So just all these little things that may take effort or may take some financing, but it does actually add value to your yield and to your crop. Our bags have been yielding like average per pound, like they've been like 85 to 90 pounds a bag. So it's been pretty consistent as we've been managing all these other aspects of like fertilizing and just crop rotations, or leaving some fields furlough, not just like planting them back to back like how we used to. We face such challenges with like just birds and ducks. So the fields aren't even like wholly planted. There will be a lot of missing areas because there's just these types of things that happen. Pig devastation is another thing. So you're not necessarily counting a whole field that's like half eaten or what have you. So there's definitely a lot more work to be done.
Do you have any memories that stand out for you as maybe like one of the last times you were out here with your grandfather?
Oh yeah. That literally like the weekend he passed away. It was a Sunday that he passed, and Saturday we were here. And again, he was building, it was a little hut for one of the pumps, and I was here with him, and it was always like always testing us. It was always like passing him the right tools. Can you give me the Allen wrench, or can you pass me, you know, the flathead screwdriver? And you're like digging in the tool bag that has like a million tools, and you're like, is it this one? And he's like, no, like, what is wrong with you? I said the flathead. And you're just like, oh, okay, like just scattered and flustered. But I was here with him. And then I remember like he went home, and I would always like check on him, make sure he's good. And then I'd go home myself. And the next day that's when I came to check on him, and that's when I found him. But, like, I was always with him. So, like, to found him at home, passed away, wasn't, it was, like, I was comforted knowing he was home. It was a shock, though, to just, like, I'm like, of course you do this to me. It's me, of course, again. Like, I found my grandma, I found you. I'm like, y'all be testing me over here and my strength. I was always with him every day, like, doctors, town runs, farm, always.
It's remarkable that he was out here giving you tool instructions the day before he passed, working his tail off the day before he passed.
Yeah, like when he wasn't at the farm, then you knew, like, okay, you're really not feeling well. Like, something's really wrong. Having kids of my own now, it's like, it's kind of like I'm thinking beyond myself and just beyond just this business. But, like, how else am I going to be of service or provide this and to teach my own? And to see, like, especially my daughter, who's three, who's able to be here on the farms, and she's all in it, like, gets in there and knocks a snail leg. She picks up the snails. And to see that, it's like flashback in time for me. It's exactly like how I was raised, like, on a farm. I was more of a flower child, but I, like, just her having that happiness and that pure, like, priceless look and value, little does she know how enriching it is. I'm like, that's what it's about. And that's what makes me, again, validate, like, why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I'm here to do just beyond me now. My daughter is going to be, like, what, seventh generation and then some. It's just huge. And I think that, yeah, like, when I talk about it with people and have these conversations, sometimes I forget, like, how important that is, like, that generational, that wealth and that legacy and just continuing on is, like, it's almost like not a dying breed, but it is pretty, like, outnumbered, like, especially with cauliflower farmer, because everybody's like, it's hard work, but it's like, yeah, it's so beyond work to us.
I like your use of wealth there. I have a feeling it has a more expansive meaning than most people might think at first.
To me, it's like, yes, there's a monetary means to what we do. Like, I am a self-employed taro farmer. That is what I do. It's my bread and butter, if you will. But it's so much more than that. For us, we're like, we're so enriched with what we do. We can pull our food out of the ground and we don't have to go to a Costco. So, like, it's so much more for us. We're not trying to go beyond our means. We're comfortable and we're just being realistic with what we can do. It's beyond just the paycheck to me. I am here because it's what I'm supposed to. Imagine what this would be like if I wasn't here. I'm sure it would have turned into something else by now. It's the true wealth and the true, like, honor of just being able to do this and to be here. Even if I struggle at times or I'm faced with things, you just keep going. And, like, ask for help. I think that's one thing I definitely learned, is to just not sit there. Just be vulnerable and ask and just seek whatever resource you need. And I think that ultimately, like, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I wouldn't want to do anything otherwise. And I only want to grow and do more things and do as much farming as I can, especially while I'm young, and doing it for my kids and being able to show them that. It just, I don't know, it just almost, like, lo and behold, just feels like it's just all working out and meant to be. Not having my grandparents and all of them to be here now, I feel them so strongly. So it feels good to just know this is where I'm supposed to be, and I feel good doing it. I feel very safe and I feel secured at the farms and my best. And so to bring my own family and to share it with other people, that's truly what matters, and I'm really stoked to be able to do so.
That was Sierra Lynn Stone, a sixth generation kalo farmer on the north shore of Kauai. HBR's D.W. Gibson produced this story. We'll have pictures of the farm and Stone's family on our website later today.
HPR is celebrating the season with special programming on HPR 1 and HPR 2. See the full lineup at hawaiipublicradio.org/holiday. Sponsored by Maui Fruit Jewels as a gift to the community.
The healthcare fight in Congress has reached another standstill. Congress is preparing to leave Capitol Hill without a resolution to expiring Obamacare tax credits. This has driven a wedge between some Republican members and leadership. We'll talk about whether the battle over healthcare costs is loosening GOP leaders' control of the party. I'm David Green. Join Mo Alethi, Mike Dupke, and me for the next Left, Right, and Center.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohavai.
Time now to kick off today's backyard quiz. As we close out the year, one of our favorite sports stories from 2025 is that of Rainbow Warriors kicker Kansei Matsuzawa. Known as the Tokyo Toe, the 26-year-old grew up in Japan and played soccer most of his life. But after attending an NFL game in 2021, Matsuzawa decided he wanted to try football. He taught himself how to kick field goals from YouTube videos, which led to an opportunity to play for Hocking College in Ohio. In 2023, he transferred to UH, but didn't play until 2024. And this year, he became one of the best collegiate kickers in the country, attempting 63 kicks and missing only one all season. He was named a finalist for the Lou Groza Award, given to the best kicker in college sports. He was also named to the Associated Press All-American team. But did you know that Matsuzawa is the second UH football player to earn that honor? For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us who was the first? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NereidHawaii.com.
We now take you to a mosh pit. In 1992, the band Nirvana ended their Pacific tour with two nights at Pink's Garage in Honolulu. A newly digitized recording lets us listen back to the set for the very first time. It was at a pivotal moment for the American rock band. Nirvana had just catapulted to unwanted stardom with the song Smells Like Teen Spirit. And lead singer Kurt Cobain had married Courtney Love on that trip to Honolulu. Ron Whitfield was an amateur bootlegger who snuck a recorder into Pink's garage concert. He and Nirvana archivist Nicholas Sarah worked to digitize the recordings. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Sarah and Whitfield about their unlikely collaboration. Whitfield takes us back to the night of the concert.
I had known of Nirvana, and all this new grunge scene started around 1990 when I started getting into bootlegging. And lo and behold, there was good stuff to tape. And I really wasn't into Nirvana, but gotta go see the concert. And so I brought my tape recorder. Things started going south, and I shoved it all in my pocket, thinking I turned it off. But everything survived. And lo and behold, here we are.
Wow. And we're talking about a recording from the 90s. Just give a quick definition of bootlegging for our listeners.
Sure. About circa 1970, unofficial recordings, usually of live concerts, were becoming a thing. They were albums. So 15-year-old me, I'm buying all the good Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, and lo and behold, here are these bootlegs for $3 and $5 a piece. And I'm buying them up. I am buying them up and loving it. And that planted the seed to get going on what I wanted to do to preserve shows for myself. Took 20 years to do it, but got it happening finally. Then the stuff sat in storage for another 20 or so years. Nick found out from a post on a Nirvana site about it. And he called up got everything connected and figured out, and now we can move on. Share them.
Yeah, Nick, here is a perfect point for you to chime in and talk a little bit about what your site does and your personal relationship with Nirvana.
Yeah, sure. I didn't even really like music that much, but like 13, 14 year old me, one day just heard a Nirvana track and became obsessed with it. Joined a Nirvana forum when I was 14 years old back in 2002. And a lot of that really shaped my entire life around videography and photography and live music and rock and roll. And just a lot of my hobbies came from those initial things. So the reality is Nirvana and their music really shaped a lot of my life. It's crazy to think about now, you know, 20 something years later, we're this community of Nirvana enthusiasts and live music archivists. And we spend our volunteer time, our hobby time, our free time, just hunting down these long lost tapes that are in shoeboxes and in closets and under beds, you know, of Nirvana and of other bands. And we do what we can to save them before they end up in the landfill eventually. So, you know, what we do and our goal is just to find this stuff, get it out into the world so people can enjoy it and people can reconnect with it. And the people that went to these shows can hear it again. We think it's valuable work and it's a lot of fun to do.
And you shared with me some really interesting lore about these two shows that happened in Honolulu in the 90s. So tell our listeners, what made these two shows notable and special, and why were you trying to get your hands on recordings from this night in particular?
Yeah, so these shows are the two only shows that Nirvana played in Hawaii, and it came at a really interesting time for the band. This is after 7 months of touring on the Nirvana worldwide tour, basically. This is the end of their Pacific Rim tour. This is really a transitional time for the band because Nevermind is released in September of 91, and they're still relatively an underground rock band. They're popular, but they're not mainstream by any means. And seemingly overnight, now they're the biggest band in the world. And they go from playing small gigs, small shows, to absolutely selling out and packing these places. So, you know, Pink's Garage in Honolulu is a relatively small venue. So they were booked for two nights. These are the last two shows of the Pacific Rim tour. And they just packed the place. And the interesting thing is, we have a lot of recordings of Nirvana over the years. The first night at Pink's, we have never had anything from. So night two, the second February show, we have maybe 10 minutes of video clips, almost no audio recordings of it. In night one, we have never heard anything. So everything that we have to go by from this first sort of legendary show was just from fans telling us their descriptions of what they remember, eyewitness accounts from like the Pink's Garage Facebook group, photos. There was one photographer there, Bob Velez, that captured a bunch of photos of both of these nights, and that's all we had. So it's sort of a rare occasion when one of these tapes pops up of a show that nobody's ever heard before. And when it happens, maybe once, maybe twice a year, we really try to celebrate it, and we truly, really try to throw it out into the world and let everybody enjoy it.
Ron, had you been to shows at Pink's Garage before?
Absolutely. It was a dinky place. It was just an old, not even a warehouse. It was just a storefront with space, you know, high ceiling, old, it was very old. And it was a great place to get in there and sweat. It really made you sweat.
What did you think about the concert as a concert goer?
It was great. You knew you were seeing something new and going to be big. How big, you don't know. But again, this was the wedding show for those two, Courtney and Kurt. They got married in Hawaii, I think, after this show and before the second. I'm not sure, but that was the wedding shows.
I think now is probably the perfect moment to take a listen to some of the recordings and talk through some of the quirks, some of the interesting moments in them.
Sure thing. You know, one other tidbit about this show, which is funny, is, you know, there were two nights, and obviously Smells Like Teen Spirit is the huge hit of the time. It's what the band's been blowing up over it. By this time, they're probably already kind of sick of it. So what's interesting is if you went to the first night, you got to hear Smells Like Teen Spirit. And if you went to the second night, they basically played a couple notes and then just bailed. So it's interesting to watch the folks that went to Pink's Garage all the time talk about these Nirvana shows and who were the ones that were able to hear Smells Like Teen Spirit and who were the ones that weren't. So let me play you a quick minute of that one. ¶¶
We should have been doing a three-man mosh pit.
Yeah, what's funny is, you know, this is the tail end of 7 months of nonstop touring. And I think by the time they get to the show, they're worn out. Kurt is, the second night he comes up and the first thing he says is, we've been touring for 7 months, you know, kind of exasperated. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I love live music so much is, yes, a lot of bands have amazing shows and there's an amazing live concert. But a lot of times you get weird shows, you get bad shows, you get shows with technical difficulties, you get shows where Kurt jumps into the crowd and ends up fighting the bouncer. I mean, those are the shows that I want to hear, especially as a Nirvana fan, because these are the only new things we get to hear, you know?
Want to play us that last clip?
Yeah, sure. So one of the interesting pieces of the first night here was all the notes we have for the show were just from people that attended the concert that night. A lot of it from the Pink's Garage Facebook group, a bunch of just fans. And we would ask, hey, do you guys remember what happened? And one of the notes was that at some point during the show, Kurt had some kind of equipment issue or something happened and basically his guitar malfunctioned and he took it and he threw it into the back of the venue and broke a mirror and just said, screw it. So, you know, what's fun is we have all these eyewitness accounts of what happened at these shows. And then we get a recording of that show and we go, okay, did this happen? Did this happen? And a lot of them, yes, we then check that box off and we get to hear the thing that we've always been wondering about. Here's Lounge Act. They get about halfway through and something happens. And I think Kurt just takes his guitar and chucks it. And you can definitely hear it.
Jimi Hendrix, but it still sounded good.
I think they fix his guitar up and they go pick it up again and they play it. So these things happen and they're great to hear 30 years later, you know?
That's such a moment and we haven't heard it until now. Ron, do you still go to shows and do this?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no more music scene in Hawaii. It's all gone. So there's nothing, even Hawaiian music, which I also did a ton of. You know, I got in on the last of the good stuff, and unfortunately, there is nothing worth taping anymore. So I got everything ready to go, but if it ever happens, I hope to be there.
Nick, any closing thoughts or reactions that you hope people will have when you release these recordings?
Yeah, we're going to do a YouTube live premiere of the whole thing within a couple of weeks, hopefully. And a whole bunch of Nirvana enthusiasts are just going to line up and we're going to listen to it together and really decipher it and go through everything and enjoy it. With stuff like this, we always like to throw it out in the world because really the goal is to keep finding more. You know what I mean? There's a ticking clock on all these tapes. And it's not that often that we find someone like Ron who is generous enough and just says, sure, let's do it. Here's what I recorded, and then ships his entire collection over to somebody in Ohio across the country. So the end goal is that we're really trying to find these tapes before they literally turn to dust or before they end up in a landfill. We're trying to preserve this music history and we're trying to archive all of it. So really, we're going to take this time. We're going to enjoy this new music that we get to hear for the first time ever. And then hopefully more people are going to see it and more people are going to be motivated to crawl into the closet, open that shoebox, dig those tapes out. Send them our way. Come find us on Live Nirvana social media and let us know what you recorded because we want to hear it and that stuff's worthwhile.
That was Ron Woodfield and Nicholas Serra talking with HGR's Matty Bender about a 1992 Nirvana concert at Pink's Garage in Honolulu, heard once again more than three decades later.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, developing tailored energy conservation solutions. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
This week on This American Life. Nearly every night in Portland, left-wing protesters and right-wing streamers face off in the streets. But it's not like you think. They know each other really well. These are right-wing streamers at the apartment of one of the protesters. That's this week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting A Charlie Brown Christmas with jazz trumpeter Mike Lewis and friends December 24th and 25th in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Early in the show, we told you about University of Hawaii kicker Kansei Matsuzawa, nicknamed the Tokyo Toe. Matsuzawa was a finalist for the Lou Groza Award given to the top college football place kicker in the country. He's planning to enter the 2026 NFL Draft. We told you that he's the second Rainbow Warrior ever to be named to the Associated Press All-American team. And we asked you to tell us who the first was. Well, our mystery man was a defensive lineman who was part of the 1987 Rainbow Warrior team. He was also the youngest of three brothers who all played for UH. All three eventually made it to the NFL. This defensive terror was drafted into the league in 1988 by the Minnesota Vikings in the third round. He played for multiple teams over his career before retiring in 1999. He was ranked 46th place on Sports Illustrated's list of the 50 greatest Hawaii sports players. And if you track Hawaii's professional athletes, past and present, then you know we're talking about Alapati Alanoga. Congrats to Matt of Honolulu. You got it right. That's our quiz for today. If you have one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we end our show this week with a piece of design that once it's on your radar, you can't unsee it. That certainly happened with the curator at the Honolulu Museum of Art, who is the driving force behind an exhibit that opened earlier this month. The show is called Let Trade Winds Flow, and it focuses on a design feature that many know as breeze block. Tori Laitola stopped by our studios recently to talk about this architectural design feature.
It's an exhibition of architectural photographs of mid-20th century architecture throughout all of Hawaii. And it was really inspired by the work of Doho Momo, that advocacy group for mid-century architecture. And there's a Hawaii chapter, and they came out with a book a few years ago called Screen Blocks in Hawaii. And it's a beautiful book, photography by David Franzen, of breeze block or screen block examples all over Honolulu. And I was like, this is really interesting. And what I tell people is, why is the curator of textiles doing this exhibition on architecture in it? It really is the fabric of our community. And they create these tapestries on buildings. And I always look at iconography and patterns, and this is just a way to look at patterns on buildings.
Yeah, they are just a part of our life, either walking to school or driving to work. And you just see these 2-3-story walk-ups, and it's just part of what we grew up with.
Yeah, and private residences, anywhere from holding up the mailbox to the carport dividers. But then you have those large condominiums that will go up 20 stories, and you might have breeze block wrapping around a staircase or the lobby, and it's really this like tapestry of shade and light as opposed to just a plain solid concrete wall.
I was driving to the airport to catch the first flight out, and as I was coming down on Punchbowl, the Department of Transportation building, the stairwell was lit up, and it just was beautiful just to see it like that, and it just jumped off the page.
When talking to people about this exhibit, and particularly after they've seen the photographs or they're familiar with the publication, and once you know about it, you can't unsee it. You start looking for it.
Yeah, and it's all types. I know I was over at a big box store and I was checking out the breeze blocks. They only had one style. But talk about the different patterns.
There are many of them. And I know that Screen blocked is the general term, but in Hawaii, we have the trade winds. And so we like the term breeze, but breeze also relates to one of the materials of the concrete that makes up the block, which is a byproduct to make it lighter. So that's breeze, coke breeze. But when they make all these forms, they have different names. And I like to sometimes use breeze block as a verb. Let's go breeze blocking. And just the other day, I had some of the staff from Talco. So they still make breeze block, and we have breeze block in the exhibition, and they were going through, and one of the guys was like pointing, oh yeah, that's 397 or it's 425. And they were sold with trade names, and some of them were exotic sounding, but you can start recognizing these specific patterns like Empress or Vista Vu or Vista Pacifico or Venetian. And they're generally accepted to be these names, and they were developed by the sales department to sell these bricks, but they do have some kind of fanciful names.
I just know I remember seeing a picture that was in the paper, and it was a walk up along Date Street, and it was someone on the sidewalk, and the photographer just captured this wonderful moment, this point in time. But it just evokes this, I don't know, very peaceful feeling of growing up in the tropics where you have the trades.
It is a current iteration of a long line of architectural screens to protect the building and give some shade, comfort, and privacy, because they're not structural. They're not load-bearing walls. But they really do create that colorful tapestry, and whether it's the play of the shadow, like you were saying, if they're lit from the inside. And actually, there's one block that's called Double Y. And so it's a rectangular block with the lines in the middle. So it's two Ys together. But I've seen it installed vertically with some colored glass, and it has almost a stained glass effect.
Wow. Oh, where is that?
It's a private residence.
Oh, okay. It's funny because thanks to Dokomomo, I've been enlightened about these architectural features. And when I went home to Guam a year or so ago, and you have a Guam connection too, but I was surprised to see at Anderson Air Force Base, it was the fence along the base, and there was miles of breeze block with barbed wire on top. It was such a juxtaposition, something decorative and useful, but it softened the idea of the barbed wire.
Do you think the barbed wire came after the breeze block?
I don't know. But it's fascinating. So it's not just Hawaii, but it's in the tropics.
A breeze block as the standardized modern form of basically the foot square brick starts in California and goes throughout the Sun Belt of North America. And so it does come to Hawaii in 1955, one of its first examples. And so you have this post-World War building boom. And you're thinking, not everyone's air-conditioned yet, but you want to have some privacy. And so it really is like the late 1950s to the 1980s. This is breeze block time period. And there are many companies all over Hawaii. And they were manufactured locally. Concrete products can be developed in a plant, but sometimes an architect would design a block or a pattern for a specific project. And they'd have the molds, and they would just create block just for that building.
I'm sometimes not sure what to consider breeze block, because something that I see is decorative, and then I'm like, maybe not. And I know I happened to see something in the facade of the Department of Agriculture along King Street, and it was Hawaiian in nature. You know, it was the warriors. It was part of the insignia. So I don't know. Is that considered breeze block? It's made out of concrete tile.
There are different iterations. You do have cast concrete panels, and you have shadow block, which is another category of molded breeze block. But breeze block is really pierced, and it has to go all the way through. And for the most part, it is a standardized 12 inches by 12 inches. And they also have half blocks or rectangular. In that category, it's basically pre-made, standardized, pierced concrete molded unit. There's all different types of other building materials. And in fact, at the museum, we actually put together a little tour. You can read it through our newsletter, but also in our gallery, we talk about the antecedents of breeze block, because we actually have one of my favorites is pierced glazed Chinese tile. So as you go around some of the older neighborhoods, you have these houses from the early part of the 20th century and earlier, and you'll see them. And there are still a few on Kino Street, and we have some at the museum. And they're roughly 12 inches by 12 inches, and it's pierced glazed tile with motifs on it, and they would be used as ventilation or windows or privacy in a wall. And so you have all these older iterations that develop into the standard concrete block we see today.
Do you have any other favorites or that you can send our listeners to go check out?
Just walk around the neighborhood. There's some beautiful examples in Makiki. I was talking to some of our colleagues. Where do you go to see Breezeblock? It's really like these buildings from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And there's a few buildings, condominiums in Makiki, where they're 20 stories high, and even on University of Hawaii campus, that just wrap or the front facade of a building. And it's really just 10 stories of Breezeblock, you know, 10 stories of Breezeblock.
It's funny because when you say you can't unsee it, once you learn about it, I was pulling out of the driveway at Bishop Museum and I snapped a picture and I was like, oh, I got to send this to Tori.
I do remember that.
But yeah, so anything that you want to let our listeners know about the exhibit that's underway now?
So the exhibit brings together six photographers from Hawaii that picked up Breezeblock all over. Because I know we talk about Oahu a lot, but it was actually on Kauai, Hawaii Island, Maui, and then Molokai. And they're slightly different because they were manufactured locally. The aggregate's different. And so I was really noticing the one in Hilo, you kind of get these black flecks in there because of the local material that's made in the fabrication of the blocks. But the exhibition has six artists, and we do cover more than just Oahu, so Hawaii Island, Molokai, Maui, and Kauai. And you might recognize a favorite landmark within those works or just residential neighborhoods. And sometimes it's just one block or an entire facade.
Okay. And then you have a talk scheduled also around the subject.
We do have a gallery talk coming up. It's unfortunately sold out on the 19th.
Okay. But that shows just how popular this topic is.
Yeah. And what's great is that last year's exhibition I did on Aloha, or Fashioning Aloha. And I had a Breezeblock shirt by Roberta Oakes in there, with her collaboration between Roberta Oakes and Breezeblock Boutique. And that was like my little teaser for this exhibition. So Roberta Oakes did launch a new line of Breezeblock Aloha wear with this exhibition.
Okay, all right. So if you've got one of those in your closet or you're going to go pick one up, you can wear it to the exhibit.
Yes, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, Tori, let's go Breezeblocking.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
The exhibit is called Let Trade Winds Flow. It's the subject of a talk tonight at the Honolulu Museum of Art, but it is sold out. The Breezeblock photo exhibit features work of six photographers, Andy Burrell, James Charisma, David Franzen, as well as Michelle Machina, James Nakamura, and Kahale Nehu Ramos. It'll be on view through March 2026. Look for links to the show on our website later today. In full disclosure, the Honolulu Museum of Art is an HPR underwriter. Well, that does it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we consider the generosity of our community to help those in need. We talk with the Hawaii Community Foundation. Leave us some feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our shows on our website or on Spotify or Apple. Our show is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.